Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Welcome, everyone. How's it going? Try it again. Welcome, everybody. All right. It brings me great pleasure to welcome you here and to see you all here on this beautiful night to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Louise Gluck. My name is Kenneth Clark. I'm the executive director of the Poetry Center of Chicago, an organization established by Chicago poets in 1973 and has presented hundreds and hundreds of the world's poets to the people of Chicago. This is the first reading of the Poetry Center's 32nd annual reading series. The Poetry Center has a good season ahead and lots of good work to do. Pick up a brochure if you haven't already. And last June, the Poetry Center published the 2003-2004 Hands-on Stanzas Anthology of Poetry. It's a book full of 1,700 poems written by kids all over the city, as young as 2nd grade, as old as 12th grade. They wrote these poems through the Poetry Center's program Hands-on Stanzas. It's a program that employs Chicago poets to teach students how to read, discuss, write, and then present poetry. And then all those kids work with their poet in residence and do a outreach to the entire school project that will collectively reach about 15,000 kids with poetry. So you can pick up a copy of the book in the back. It's pretty cool. And especially for this evening, the Poetry Center has created a limited edition art print. The print features a poem by Louise Gluck and an image by the painter Vera Clement. It's beautiful, and it's in the back as well at the book table. I want to thank the volunteers who helped out with the tables tonight. They're at the back table. They were the people who greeted you. I also want to thank the board of directors, the advisory board, and my staff, Shirley Stevenson and Michelle Taransky, who worked very hard so the Poetry Center can produce events like this one. And just give them a round of applause because they do a lot of hard work. This evening is sponsored by, in part, by a person who wishes to remain anonymous. You know who you are. We thank you for your loyal and generous support of the Poetry Center. And also, equally importantly, this evening is the Martha Friedberg Memorial Reading, named in honor of one of the Poetry Center's founders. Because of her generous support, the Poetry Center, both in her life and after, the Poetry Center has thrived. I'm stuck to tape here. It's quite amazing. Glad that happened to me and not you. Okay. In passing, Martha left the Poetry Center a bequest, and this contribution has given the Poetry Center the courage to thrive. We have leveraged her bequest to create a small rainy day fund, to attract new sponsors, to strengthen the reading series, and the Hands-on Stanzas program was completely restructured 4 years ago to reach as many students as I previously told you. Martha continues to be one of the Poetry Center's staunchest supporters through her generosity back in the 90s, and we thank and honor her generosity, her vision for the Poetry Center, and the example she provides. I do wish there were more like her. With the exception of Paul Carroll and Martha Friedberg, three of the founding board members, there were five of them, John Rezik, Mark Perlberg, and Liesl Mueller are in the room this evening, so together they can attest the lasting impact that Martha had on the Poetry Center. The Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute. They let us use this ballroom to hold poetry readings throughout the year. Support comes from Target Stores, the Lannan Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, Polk Brothers Foundation, the Boeing Company, the Chicago Community Trust, MacArthur Fund for Arts and Culture at Richard H. Driehaus Foundation, a new grant from the Henrietta Lang Burke Fund, the Lewis R. Laurie Foundation, Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Department of Cultural Affairs, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, Bank One, the Northern Trust Centennial Fund of the Chicago Community Trust, LaSalle Bank, the Seabury Foundation, Alan and Lynn Turner, and others. And I read all those off to you because I want you to know how many people are supporting poetry and the Poetry Center. Special thanks to Chicago Access Network Television. And now I'm done with the commercials and can say a bit about tonight's person who will introduce tonight's poet. In 2003, Kevin Stein was named the fourth poet laureate of Illinois by Governor Rod Blagojevich. Stein is the author of 5 books of poetry, 2 prose works, and an anthology of Illinois poets called Illinois Voices. He is a highly decorated award-winning poet. His collection, Chance Ransom, published in 2000, was nominated for a Pulitzer. He is currently the Caterpillar Professor of English at Bradley University in Peoria. Please welcome the Poet Laureate of the great state of Illinois, Kevin Stein.
I have to pull the microphone down. What a beautiful venue this is, and I successfully negotiated the stairs, and that gives me great joy. Among the most critically recognized of current American poets, Louise Glick has authored 9 poetry books and a collection of essays. For these works, Glick has garnered a trainload of awards, including, and relax now because this train will take a while to clear the tracks, the 1993 Pulitzer Prize for her collection, The Wild Iris, my favorite, the Bollingen Prize, the Penn Martha Albrand Award for the essays of Proofs and Theories, a magnificent text if you've not yet seen it, the National Book Critics Circle Award for The Triumph of Achilles, the Boston Globe Literary Press Award for Poetry, fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations, and 2 honors from the Poetry Society of America, their Melville Kane Award and the William Carlos Williams Award. She has also received the Bobbitt National Prize for Poetry from the Library of Congress. Given this broadly warm reception, it's no surprise that Glick serves as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Complementing all of these remarkable achievements as a poet is her long career as a highly regarded teacher at Williams College. These are the facts, but when have the facts ever amply measured experience? I have always admired Louise Glick's poems because she does what I am preternaturally incapable of doing. She bites her tongue. She knows that a poem's size is best understood not as a measure of length, but as a gauge of spirit. And the spirit, which is necessarily unseen, is often best expressed in the unspoken. Here's Glick on the allure of not saying. I am attracted to ellipsis, to the unsaid, the suggestion, to eloquent, deliberate silence. The unsaid for me exerts great power. Often I wish an entire poem could be made in this vocabulary. This vocabulary of silence amounts to a willful unsaying. This is not Wittgenstein's notion in his Tractatus of the limits of language, his belief that what cannot be said must be passed over in silence. This is not his belief in language as a cage against whose walls we fling ourselves in futile attempt to say what we mean. No, Glick knows quite well what can be said. She simply chooses not to, at least not often in words. In the purest sense, then, and this looms immensely important, her poems invoke a testament to the powers of language, the power even of language's elisions and silences and absences. Glick's poems offer us the paradoxical presence of absence, where what is missing achingly implies the beauty of what once was but no longer is. Her poems ride a teeter-totter of decorum and disclosure, the polar urges of any lyric. In them, each flight of disclosure is balanced by the invisible gravity of decorum. Hers are poems of demure intimacy. Is not a measure of intimacy to be forever on the verge of divulging something that in the end one need not say at all? In sum, familiar forces, forces familiar to us all, animate Glick's works. On one hand, she tells us, we inhabit a world in which you are compelled to, quote, love what won't love you back. On the other, we realize that, quote, those with the smallest hearts have the greatest freedom. Her noble question is simply how to love with a knowing but reckless abandon what is sure to abandon us. It's my pleasure to introduce Louise Glick.
Still. Can you hear? How is this? Is this working? Yes? Yes. I'm going to read three, this sounds ridiculous after the introduction, long poems from my new book, and maybe one very short one. The book is thematically held together by an idea of Avernus, the place which the Romans thought to be the entry to the underworld. It's concern, that of the book, not that of the place, is the traffic between the worlds of the dead and the living. The first poem that I'd like to read is called Landscape. It has six sections, each self-contained, and in this instance, quite self-contained, in that you won't find, I think, a narrative, I dare you to find, a narrative link from one to the other. The individual poems are vignettes, like strange, I think of them as memories or visions of previous sojourns on earth. You will hear, I think, recurrences, not just recurrences of language, but there are figures, animals that show up in more than one of the poems. They're numbered, and I'll read the numbers. Landscape, 1. The sun is setting behind the mountains. The earth is cooling. A stranger has tied his horse to a bare chestnut tree. The horse is quiet. He turns his head suddenly, hearing in the distance the sound of the sea. I make my bed for the night here, spreading my heaviest quilt over the damp earth. The sound of the sea. When the horse turns its head, I can hear it. On a path through the bare chestnut trees, a little dog trails its master. The little dog, didn't he used to rush ahead, straining the leash, as though to show his master what he sees there in the future, the path, call it what you will. Behind the trees at sunset, it is as though a great fire is burning between two mountains, so that the snow on the highest precipice seems for a moment to be burning also. Listen. At the path's end, the man is calling out. His voice has become very strange now, the voice of a person calling to what he can't see. Over and over, he calls out among the dark chestnut trees until the animal responds faintly from a great distance, as though this thing we fear were not terrible. Twilight. The stranger has untied his horse. the sound of the sea, just memory now. 2. Time passed, turning everything to ice. Under the ice, the future stirred. If you fell into it, you died. It was a time of waiting, of suspended action. I lived in the present, which was that part of the future you could see. The past floated above my head, like the sun and moon, visible but never reachable. It was a time governed by contradictions, as in, I felt nothing and I was afraid. Winter emptied the trees, filled them again with snow. Because I couldn't feel, snow fell, the lake froze over. Because I was afraid, I didn't move. My breath was white, a description of silence. Time passed, and some of it became this. And some of it simply evaporated. You could see it float above the white trees, forming particles of ice. All your life you wait for the propitious time. Then the propitious time reveals itself as action taken. I watched the past move, a line of clouds moving from left to right or right to left, depending on the wind. Some days there was no wind. The clouds seemed to stay where they were, like a painting of the sea, more still than real. Some days, the lake was a sheet of glass. Under the glass, the future made demure, inviting sounds. You had to tense yourself so as not to listen. Time passed. You got to see a piece of it. The years it took with it were years of winter. They would not be missed. Some days, there were no clouds, as though the sources of the past had vanished. The world was bleached like a negative. The light passed directly through it. Then the image faded. Above the world, there was only blue, blue everywhere. 3. In late autumn, a young girl set fire to a field of wheat. The autumn had been very dry. The field went up like tinder. Afterward, there was nothing left. You walk through it, you see nothing. There's nothing to pick up, to smell. The horses don't understand it. Where is the field, they seem to say, the way you and I would say, where is home? No one knows how to answer them. There is nothing left. You have to hope for the farmer's sake. The insurance will pay. It is like losing a year of your life. To what would you lose a year of your life? Afterward, you go back to the old place. All that remains is char, blackness, and emptiness. You think, how could I live here? But it was different then, even last summer. The earth behaved as though nothing could go wrong with it. One match was all it took. But at the right time, it had to be the right time. The field parched, dry, the deadness in place already, so to speak. 4. I fell asleep in a river, I woke in a river. Of my mysterious failure to die, I can tell you nothing, neither who saved me nor for what cause. There was immense silence, no wind, no human sound. The bitter century was ended, the glorious gone, the abiding gone, the cold sun persisting as a kind of curiosity, a memento, time streaming behind it. The sky seemed very clear as it is in winter, the soil dry, uncultivated, the official light calmly moving through a slot in air, dignified, complacent, dissolving hope, subordinating images of the future to signs of the future's passing. I think I must have fallen. When I tried to stand, I had to force myself, being unused to physical pain. I had forgotten how harsh these conditions are. The earth not obsolete, but still, the river cold, shallow. Of my sleep, I remember nothing. When I cried out, my voice soothed me unexpectedly. In the silence of consciousness, I asked myself, why did I reject my life? And I answer, die Erde überwältigt mich. The earth defeats me. I have tried to be accurate in this description, in case someone else should follow me. I can verify that when the sun sets in winter, it is incomparably beautiful, and the memory of it lasts a long time. I think this means there was no night. The night was in my head. 5. After the sun set, we rode quickly in the hope of finding shelter before darkness. I could see the stars already, first in the eastern sky. We rode, therefore, away from the light and toward the sea, since I had heard of a village there. After some time, the snow began. Not thickly at first, then steadily until the earth was covered with a white film. The way we traveled showed clearly when I turned my head. For a short while, it made a dark trajectory across the earth. Then the snow was thick, the path vanished. The horse was tired and hungry. He could no longer find sure footing anywhere. I told myself, I have been lost before. I have been cold before. The night has come to me exactly this way as a premonition. And I thought, if I am asked to return here, I would like to come back as a human being and my horse to remain himself. Otherwise, I would not know how to begin again. I think I owe that poem to this city. The first part of it that was written was the second section, which was actually published as a separate poem in Three Penny Review a long time ago. And that poem was the first poem I'd written in years. It came out of doing the I Ching with my cousin. And I think that some of you who know the I Ching will hear in that the language of that seeking. The next poem is very different in tone. It's got 20 sections. Don't be frightened. They're all very short. And its preoccupation is the issue of romantic love, the rearing of children into it, into its mythologies, the toxic nature of some of those mythologies. The poem is called Prism. One. Who can say what the world is? The world is in flux, therefore unreadable. The wind shifting, the great plates invisibly shifting and changing. Two. Dirt. Fragments of blistered rock on which the exposed heart constructs a house, memory, the gardens manageable, small in scale, the beds damp at the sea's edge. Three. As one takes in an enemy, through these windows one takes in the world. Here is the kitchen. Here the darkened study, meaning I am master here. Four. When you fall in love, my sister said, it's like being struck by lightning. She was speaking hopefully to draw the attention of the lightning. I reminded her that she was repeating exactly our mother's formula, which she and I had discussed in childhood, because we both felt that what we were looking at in the adults were the effects not of lightning, but of the electric chair. Five. Riddle. Why was my mother happy? Answer. She married my father. Six. You girls, my mother said, should marry someone like your father. That was one remark. Another was, there is no one like your father. Seven. From the pierced clouds, steady lines of silver, unlikely yellow of the witch hazel, veins of mercury that were the paths of the rivers, then the rain again, erasing footprints in the damp earth, an implied path like a map without a crossroads. Eight. The implication was it was necessary to abandon childhood. The word marry was a signal. You could also treat it as aesthetic advice. The voice of the child was tiresome. It had no lower register. The word was a code, mysterious like the Rosetta Stone. It was also a road sign, a warning. You could take a few things with you, like a dowry. You could take the part of you that thought. Marry meant you should keep that part quiet. Nine. A night in summer. Outside, sounds of a summer storm. Then the sky clearing. In the window, constellations of summer. I'm in a bed. This man and I, we are suspended in the strange calm sex often induces. Most sex induces. Longing, what is that? Desire, what is that? In the window, constellations of summer. Once I could name them. 10. Abstracted shapes, patterns, the light of the mind, the cold exacting fires of disinterestedness, curiously blocked by earth, coherent, glittering in air and water, the elaborate signs that said, now plant, now harvest. I could name them. I had names for them, two different things. 11. Fabulous things, stars. When I was a child, I suffered from insomnia. Summer nights, my parents permitted me to sit by the lake. I took the dog for company. Did I say suffered? That was my parents' way of explaining tastes that seemed to them inexplicable, better suffered than preferred to live with the dog. Darkness, silence that annulled mortality, the tethered boats rising and falling. When the moon was full, I could sometimes read the girls' names painted to the sides of the boats. Ruth Ann, Sweet Izzy, Peggy, my darling. They were going nowhere, those girls. There was nothing to be learned from them. I spread my jacket in the damp sand. The dog curled up beside me. My parents couldn't see the life in my head. When I wrote it down, they fixed the spelling. Sounds of the lake. The soothing, inhuman sounds of water lapping the dock. The dog scuffling somewhere in the weeds. 12. The assignment was to fall in love. The details were up to you. The second part was to include in the poem certain words, words drawn from a specific text on another subject altogether. 13. Spring rain, then a night in summer. A man's voice, then a woman's voice. You grew up. You were struck by lightning. When you opened your eyes, you were wired forever to your true love. It only happened once. Then you were taken care of. Your story was finished. It happened once. Being struck was like being vaccinated. The rest of your life, you were immune. You were warm and dry. Unless the shock wasn't deep enough. Then you weren't vaccinated. You were addicted. 14. The assignment was to fall in love. The author was female. The ego had to be called the soul. The action took place in the body. Stars represented everything else, dreams, the mind, etc. The beloved was identified with the self in a narcissistic projection. The mind was a subplot. It went nattering on. Time was experienced less as narrative than ritual. What was repeated had weight. Certain endings were tragic, thus acceptable. Everything else was failure. 15. Deceit, lies, embellishments we call hypotheses. There were too many roads, too many versions. There were too many roads, no one path. And at the end, 16. List the implications of crossroads. Answer. A story that will have a moral. Give a counterexample. 17. The self ended and the world began. They were of equal size, commensurate. One mirrored the other. 18. The riddle was, why couldn't we live in the mind? The answer was, the barrier of the earth intervened. 19. The room was quiet. That is, the room was quiet, but the lovers were breathing. In the same way, the night was dark. It was dark, but the stars shone. The man in bed was one of several men to whom I gave my heart. The gift of the self that is without limit. Without limit, though it recurs. The room was quiet. It was an absolute, like the black night. 20. A night in summer. Sounds of a summer storm. The great plates invisibly shifting and changing. And in the dark room, the lovers sleeping in each other's arms. We are, each of us, the one who wakens first, who stirs first and sees there in the first dawn, the stranger. 2 short poems, and then one more. The night migrations. This is the moment when you see again the red berries of the mountain ash, and in the dark sky, the birds' night migrations. It grieves me to think the dead won't see them. These things we depend on, they disappear. What will the soul do for solace then? I tell myself, maybe it won't need these pleasures anymore. Maybe just not being is simply enough, hard as that is to imagine. Thrush. Snow began falling over the surface of the whole earth. That can't be true. And yet it felt true, falling more and more thickly over everything I could see. The pines turned brittle with ice. This is the place I told you about, where I used to come at night to see the red-winged blackbirds, what we call thrush here, red flicker of the life that disappears. But for me, I think the guilt I feel must mean I haven't lived very well. Someone like me doesn't escape. I think you sleep a while, then you descend into the terror of the next life, except the soul is in some different form, more or less conscious than it was before. More or less covetous. After many lives, maybe something changes. I think in the end, what you want, you'll be able to see. Then you don't need any more to die and come back again. And the last poem I'll read tonight is a poem in 6 sections. I don't write poems that anyone would call political, in that there are no overt managements of boldly political themes. But I think of this poem as one nevertheless. It was written in the aftermath of September 11th, which was, for all of us, traumatic. My experience of it was that a certain myth also was exploded. I realized, though I didn't know it until I didn't think this way anymore, thought of myself as vulnerable, neurotic, doomed, but the earth as essentially, how I managed to sustain this notion is really extraordinary, benign, mortality and hideous events notwithstanding. What I suddenly realized was that the outside world was as sick as the inside world. And so my myth of the safe place I was preparing myself through psychoanalysis to enter was destroyed. October 1. Is it winter again? Is it cold again? Didn't Frank just slip on the ice? Didn't he heal? Weren't the spring seeds planted? Didn't the night end? Didn't the melting ice flood the narrow gutters? Wasn't my body rescued? Wasn't it safe? Didn't the scar form invisible above the injury? Terror and cold, didn't they just end? Wasn't the back garden harrowed and planted? I remember how the earth felt, red and dense. In stiff rows, weren't the seeds planted? Didn't vines climb the south wall? I can't hear your voice for the wind's cries, whistling over the bare ground. I no longer care what sound it makes. When was I silenced? When did it first seem pointless to describe that sound? What it sounds like can't change what it is. Didn't the night end? Wasn't the earth safe when it was planted? Didn't we plant the seeds? Weren't we necessary to the earth? The vines, were they harvested? 2. Summer after summer has ended, bomb after violence. It does me no good to be good to me now. Violence has changed me. Daybreak. The low hills shine ochre and fire, even the fields shine. I know what I see. Sun that could be the August sun returning, everything that was taken away. You hear this voice. This is my mind's voice. You can't touch my body now. It has changed once. It has hardened. Don't ask it to respond again. A day like a day in summer. Exceptionally still. The long shadows of the maples nearly mauve on the gravel paths, and in the evening, warmth, night like a night in summer. It does me no good. Violence has changed me. My body has grown cold like the stripped fields. Now there is only my mind, cautious and wary, with the sense it is being tested. Once more, the sun rises as it rose in summer. Bounty, bomb after violence, bomb after the leaves have changed, after the fields have been harvested and turned. Tell me this is the future, I won't believe you. Tell me I'm living, I won't believe you. 3. Snow had fallen. I remember music from an open window. Come to me, said the world. This is not to say it spoke in exact sentences, but that I perceived beauty in this manner. Sunrise. A film of moisture on each living thing. Pools of cold light formed in the gutters. I stood at the doorway, ridiculous as it now seems. What others found in art, I found in nature. What others found in human love, I found in nature. Very simple. But there was no voice there. Winter was over. In the thawed dirt, bits of green were showing. Come to me, said the world. I was standing in my wool coat at a kind of bright portal. I can finally say, long ago, it gives me considerable pleasure. Beauty, the healer, the teacher. Death cannot harm me more than you have harmed me, my beloved life. 4. The light has changed. Middle sea is tuned darker now, and the songs of morning sound over-rehearsed. This is the light of autumn, not the light of spring. The light of autumn, you will not be spared. The songs have changed. The unspeakable has entered them. This is the light of autumn, not the light that says, I am reborn. Not the spring dawn, I strained, I suffered, I was delivered. This is the present, an allegory of waste. So much has changed, and still you are fortunate. The ideal burns in you like a fever, or not like a fever, like a second heart. The songs have changed, but really, they are still quite beautiful. They have been concentrated in a smaller space, the space of the mind. They are dark now with desolation and anguish. And yet the notes recur. They hover oddly in anticipation of silence. The ear gets used. The eye gets used to disappearances. You will not be spared, nor will what you love be spared. A wind has come and gone, taking apart the mind. It has left in its wake a strange lucidity. How privileged you are to be still passionately clinging to what you love. The forfeit of hope has not destroyed you. Maestoso, doloroso. This is the light of autumn. It has turned on us. Surely it is a privilege to approach the end, still believing in something. 5. It is true there is not enough beauty in the world. It is also true that I am not competent to restore it. Neither is there candor, and here I may be of some use. I am at work, though I am silent. The bland misery of the world bounds us on either side, an alley lined with trees. We are companions here, not speaking, each with his own thoughts. Behind the trees, iron gates of the private houses, the shuttered rooms somehow deserted, abandoned, as though it were the artist's duty to create hope. But out of what? What? The word itself false, a device to refute perception. At the intersection, ornamental lights of the season. I was young here, riding the subway with my small book, as though to defend myself against this same world. You are not alone, the poem said, in the dark tunnel. 6. The brightness of the day becomes the brightness of the night. The fire becomes the mirror. My friend, the earth is bitter. I think sunlight has failed her. Bitter or weary, it is hard to say. Between herself and the sun, something has ended. She wants now to be left alone. I think we must give up turning to her for affirmation. Above the fields, above the roofs of the village houses, the brilliance that made all life possible becomes the cold stars. Lie still and watch. They give nothing, but ask nothing. From within the earth's bitter disgrace, coldness and barrenness, my friend, the moon rises. She is beautiful tonight, but when is she not beautiful? Thank you.